From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we launch a new on-air book club with the hosts of GPB's A Seat at the Table. We're calling it A Book at the Table, and our first book, For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics, by a super accomplished quartet of women. Donna Brazile, Yolanda Caraway, Leah Dautry, and Mignon Moore have for decades navigated the strategies and secrets and systems of American politics and power. And here to talk about the book, Monica Pearson, Deneen Milner, and Christine White. Thank you so much for being here, ladies.
Our pleasure.
Now, we do invite you to join in this judgment-free discussion zone. You're not required to bring an app, bottle of anything. It's morning yet. And even if you haven't read the book, you can join the conversation. You can watch us. We're on Facebook Live, broadcasting from the A Seat at the Table Facebook page. You can comment in real time and in the On Second Thought Facebook group or on Twitter at OST Talk. And we're using the hashtag ABATT for A Book at the Table. We will try to read your comments in real time on the air. But now for the questions. It was Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to the U.S. Congress, who said, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. You guys have heard this. This is echoed here by Donna Brazile, one of the four authors of For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics.
And we wrote this book to encourage other women, not just black women, but every woman, to take their seats at the table. It is time that we step up.
So what does this mean for you? Why did you pick this up for your show?
Well, for me, I was lucky enough to be able to interview all four of them. And what impressed me was their guidebook, even though it looks like it's just for women who are Democrats.
Right.
I raised the question to them, is this just for Democratic women? And do you have a Republican woman you like? And they all said in unison, Condoleezza Rice. And what was so cool about it is they each really love politics, but more importantly, they are organizers.
Yes.
And the support between the four of them, and there is a fifth, but the four of them who wrote this book, I think, is a guideline for all women. How we help each other, how we go to bat for each other, even when we aren't supporting the same candidate.
Right.
We never let disagreement get between us.
Yeah, even
That's
when we
I
don't
loved.
Disagree on the same issue, they showed us that we can still support each other and still have each other's back. I think that it's an amazing story because as a sort of student of the civil rights movement, as an advocate of civic engagement, as someone who has been a part of community organizing for my whole life, really, these women are icons.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
and they are such incredible examples of people who chartered unknown territory for women of color who had never had mentors in the space, but figured out how to make it happen.
Yeah, Chris, that's Christine White speaking. One of the things that also struck me is that so many of them, they were motivated by their defiance or sense of injustice or sense of duty, but they all took on these jobs like they're in their 20s,
right.
You know, and they're
mm-hmm.
doing these huge
right.
jobs,
right.
way too big for them. And I wondered if you guys recognize that. I mean, I feel like so many women who are ambitious women that I know stepped into shoes that were way too big for them and then learned how to fill them.
Well, here's a funny story from that's not in the book, but Donna Brazile was selected. Yeah, it is in the book now that I think about it. Donna Brazile was selected by Mrs. King to work for her. And everybody right. said to Mrs.
Right.
King, oh, no, she's too young.
Right.
She went to the wrong school.
Right.
She's this. And Mrs. King saw something in her that said, she's the one to get it done.
Right.
And I think that that's an important part of that story, too, that those of us who are in positions become mentors for others and recognize the talent rather than being threatened by it.
Yeah.
You know, I loved Leah's story. I kept getting drawn into her story. Leah Dautry, who is the daughter of Herbert Dautry, who is this incredible icon of a pastor and mover, social movement mover in New York. So I'm from New York originally, and Herbert Dautry was one of those icons that if you're a New Yorker, particularly an African-American New Yorker who was dealing with all different kinds of social issues, you knew that there were certain people who were going to always be there sort of moving and advocating and talking and representing. And so to read her story from the daughter's perspective of Herbert Daughtry, and then seeing how, even as a little girl, she was there, you know, watching her father move, watching her father organize. Those people were in her living room, you know, eating from her plates, and she was serving them and watching them and listening. And I think that there's a huge service to us as mothers to read that story, because it's not just about sort of grabbing your child and dragging them out into the street and giving them a play card and saying, you know, you be here and you hold this sign, and they don't really understand. There's something about being in the room as a child.
Giving your child a seat at the table.
Right. And giving your thank you. Because what those children end up doing is growing up to be Donna Brazile and Leah Daughtry.
Right. That's Deneen Millner. I'm just identifying. Everyone's used to seeing your faces, but maybe not used to seeing your voices. And so far for comments, we're getting a lot of positive emojis. So not a lot of sort of critical comments there. But I want to pick up on that, because the other thing that she notices, now this is in the 1970s, very glamorous company at the house, by the way. Ossie Davis, you know,
Ruby Dee.
Ruby Dee, really a sort of like stardom, the celebrities of that era. But also that she notices that her father is in this coalition with four different groups, and they don't agree with each other.
Exactly.
And I think there's this kind of assumption that, you know, if you're in the resistance movement, you have to all agree with each other.
Yes.
Christine, you have thoughts on
it?
You're nodding.
Well, this is so important because, I mean, there are so many different ideas and strategies for how we get to equitable treatment in this country, how we all become equal in the eyes of the law. There are always going to be multiple strategies. But the thing is that we have to acknowledge that we all have something to add. And I think that Leah's story was really important because she did reflect this idea that she saw these people disagreeing, negotiating, arguing, debating, and then they walked away and still supported each other in the streets. They were still able to move their people for a common goal. And that's really the important thing. I mean, that we all have a common goal, that people are treated well, that everyone has equal opportunity. And as long as that is the goal, we can disagree on the tactics and the strategies, but still be in a connection with one another.
Right.
And that's so important, such an important lesson from this book.
And I think that's the reason why this book can be used as a game plan for anyone who's interested in getting into politics.
Absolutely.
I really do.
Let me tell
you.
Or social movements.
Right? Absolutely.
Because there were things in the book about, and I'm referring specifically to what you guys are talking about. There was a scene where where Leah is talking about all four of them being in the room and disagreeing, and then going out and agreeing that, okay, this thing we're going to march about.
Right.
And you're going to bring your people, I'll bring my people, and we all show up and we talk about the same thing. And I love that, because there's, you know, when you're looking at movements of today that are built around social media hashtags, they have power, but they also kind of fall, to me, to pieces, because everybody thinks that they all have to agree on everything.
And it's never been that way.
Right, never.
Ever. Yeah,
right?
And that's
so
okay.
So you can use this, like Monica said, as a blueprint. This is how it was done.
Right.
And even if these folks who are in charge or were in charge before are not showing you how to do it step by step, this right here,
it shows you.
Absolutely.
There's one other thing about this book that I think is really important and I don't want to miss, is that the historical context of what happened after the Civil Rights Movement. We learned so much about the Civil Rights Movement, but after the 60s were the 70s. After Kennedy and King were killed, there were people who had to carry on the torch and do the best that they could under the circumstances that they had.
Right.
And we, I think for a long time, particularly in the African-American community, because Reverend Jesse Jackson didn't win the presidential nomination or didn't win the Democratic nomination, he was shamed a bit. He was seen as a loser. I remember as a kid growing up and feeling a little bit ashamed that there was this person running for president that was Black, but he didn't win. And but we don't realize how important that movement was that he started in 84 and in 88. Mm-hmm. And this book is, just gives us so much context mm-hmm. and so much breath mm-hmm. around what it took for a black man to run for president mm-hmm. 20 years right.
this
before
is, this
Barack
is,
Obama.
This is pretty much right. where they all converge in this yes. 1984 yes. Yes. President. But the other thing that was so interesting to me about that is how strategic the civil rights movement had been. It was Martin Luther King Jr. who sent him, Jesse Jackson, to Chicago right. to run Operation Breadbasket. And this was an economic reform. It was about empowering right. people, you know, about giving people jobs. How absolutely complete that strategy was. Where do you think that is now?
It's sad. I'm going to tell you. I mean, I have had the pleasure of being advised by some amazing luminaries from the civil rights movement. And what I've heard over and over again is that is really where Dr. King didn't get to fulfill his mission, is really with economic expansion, really the Poor People's Campaign. And so what happened was during the Reagan years, we had people who made poverty a crime. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they used this whole idea of the welfare mother to shame black women and to shame the struggles that they had, that they undertook coming out of the South and into the industrial North, and took it out of context such that we were so afraid to even say poverty right. in this generation. And so I think it's really hard for us to grapple with the fact that we are supposed to be, you know, the number one industrialized nation. We're supposed to be head of technology, but we have such issues still with mm-hmm. economic inequality. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's we should not talk about King without talking about his stance around poverty and around economic
Absolutely.
Equality.
Because that's one of the reasons when we look at his assassination, he was there for a march for the garbage men
right.
of
mm-hmm.
Memphis. Mm-hmm. And people
Preach.
Forget that.
Right. Right.
So we are still in that box. We still don't like to talk about a wage that is livable versus a minimum wage.
Right, right, right. Yeah. There's a brilliant story that was in The Atlantic on Atlanta.com just this week that was about what would happen if Amazon ended up having its second headquarters here, and how black children who are in public schools right now would be completely shut out of the jobs that would come here, because they are mostly technology jobs. Mm. They're jobs that would bring, on average, $100,000 salaries.
Right.
And our children are not ready for those jobs.
Our education system hasn't prepared them.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, it's not just about, you know, like your mom being a single mom and
right.
not having, you know, money to, well, yeah.
Provide it's not, you it's, access.
Right,
it's more.
Right. It's way deeper than that.
Yeah.
You got to read that story.
All right. I got to cut in for just a minute. Joyce Davis says, also, model civic engagement. Another comment on Facebook Live says, this is why you should take your children with you to vote. We're going to get
yes.
to that.
Amen to that.
After that. And also, Kelly, troop common goal, hashtag unity, is what some of the comments that we're getting here. Now, we have to take a little bit of a break, but we're going to be back. We're book clubbing. We are book clubbing. There's no cover, no bouncers, but we do want you in on this conversation with Monica Pearson, Deneen Milner and Christine White. They're co-hosts of A Seat at the Table, kicking off A Book at the Table on our live. And it's on Facebook Live on the A Seat yes. at the Table Facebook page. You can comment along with us. But we're going to take a quick break. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, here with an amazing group of women, the hosts of A Seat at the Table. And we're doing our first book club of the air. We're calling it A Book at the Table because that's how snappy we are. And we... And we're discussing the book for colored girls who have considered politics. It was actually Monica Pearson's choice because Monica interviewed the four women, Donna Brazile, Yolanda Caraway, Leah Dautry, and Mignon Moore, and was really taken by this book. But, you know, for me, I'm looking at it and think this is a pretty bruising accounts of operating in the nation's halls of power. They're decisions they have to make that don't align with their community. But they are encouraging readers to dare to enter the game. I mean, would you want to do it?
No. No. Too many skeletons in the closet.
Not at all. There is no way that I could ever be anybody.
We never make it. We never make it past the vetting process, I guess.
No, ma'am.
But how about thoughts about, you know, criticism for this book? It was very insider. There's a lot of name dropping, I would have to say. And I felt
that's
like
that's what sells the book.
Well,
for
I guess okay. I'm in the wrong business, apparently.
I think in the case we were just talking about Donna Brazile off air, you know, she lost her job at CNN because she gave questions to the Clinton campaign that were going to be in the debate. And someone actually joked and said this book, since it came out in October, was part of her comeback tour. And it is a lot of inside baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for that reason, the history is more important to me.
Right.
That's in the book because we're three generations. We're sitting right here.
Right.
So there's a lot of history in this book that younger people need to know about, particularly about women in the movement, and particularly about when I talked about the movement, not just civil rights, but women in the political movement. You know, they don't know that two of these women ran the national conventions.
Right.
So, it is, I think, you have to be really interested in politics and wanting to be an organizer and wanting to be involved to want to read this book.
See, and I'm here for the insider baseball stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a former political reporter here in New York. And how else do you learn about how these movements work than to go ahead and say who the people were that were involved, what was going on down to the dirty details? And I find that criticism to be a little bit dubious because there are plenty of other political books that, talk about different movements, different people who were heads of those movements that talk insider baseball, and we don't have a problem with those. But all of a sudden, when Black women come together and they talk about the power that they had behind the scenes, then all of a sudden it's too insider baseball. What do you want them to talk about? It's a political book.
Deneen, as a reporter, a former political reporter, what did you think of, like, not mentioning at all that Donna Brazile got kicked off of CNN for that?
I mean, you know, it's Donna's book. If Donna decides she don't want to talk about it, she don't have to talk about it.
And if a reporter has read the book, they can raise the question.
Right, exactly. I mean, okay, so other hat, I am a celebrity memoirist, right?
Right.
And the big thing that we talk about going in is, okay, people are going to want to know this, that, and the other. This is a rumor. This is something that controversial that happened. And that author, that person that I'm writing the book with, it's their book. It's an autobiography. It's not a biography. And so when they decide what it is that they want to talk about or don't want to talk about, that's their prerogative.
Yeah.
So I have no problem with her not talking about it. Good for her.
I'm happy to hear that they have found ways to expose and show their human side as they made these decisions. Because a lot of things happened in the White House, and we particularly when there are very few Black people in a space, right? We tend to put the pressure on them to represent the whole Black race. And so then we dehumanize them to an extent. They have to become this figurehead, and then they're less human. And so we look at, you know, the decisions that Mignon Moore made about helping Clinton instead of helping Obama. And you know, as an outsider looking in, how could you do that? How could you break with, you know, what the community wanted you to do? But the truth of the matter is that she had relationships. She had to keep her word. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are things that that enter into people's lives that we as the public don't understand. And so we don't tend to have compassion for people in places of power. And I think that that's a real issue. We need to acknowledge ourselves and not put people at a higher standard than we would put our own selves, right? Right.
And I think that brings up to where we are today. And I noticed in the book, you know, where they say, where do we go from here? Where they talk about two people who are running for office right now in Georgia, Stacey Abrams and then also in the
Brian
sixth
Kemp.
Brian Kemp. But no, I'm talking about black women.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
Lucy
oh.
McBath.
Oh, okay. Lucy
they
McBath.
Mentioned both of them in this book. And I think that a lot of people assume automatically, if you're black and female, you've got to support. And we don't talk about names in here.
Yeah, we don't. Right?
We do
Good
not
idea.
Talk about names. But it's been surprising to me how many black women I've talked to out in the community. I'm not talking about Metro Atlanta, but out in the country, who look at Stacey and immediately start taking her apart for how they think she should look.
Oh, yeah.
Why isn't she married? Why does she wear her hair that way? Why doesn't she lose weight? And then I always have to say, well, what about her mind? Right. What about her platform? Mm-hmm. What do her looks have to do with the office that mm-hmm. she's running for? Mm-hmm. And that is a concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is also speaks to the whole celebrity. What are you presenting to the world? And of course, we had some celebrities in town. Oprah has been here stumping for Stacey Abrams. President Obama, former President Obama, is going to be here this weekend. Also, Mike Pence, the vice president,
and the president's for, coming
and
in
the
on
president
Sunday.
For Brian Kemp. But here, let's just hear a little bit of Oprah talking about.
I cast the votes for my grandmother, Hattie Mae Lee, who died in 1963 before the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and never had a chance to vote. I vote for her.
Well, so many things to pick up there, but I really want to pick up on Mike Pence's comment that he was also in the state and said, you know, I'm kind of a big deal, too. I've got a message for Will Ferrell and for Oprah and their liberal Hollywood friends. This ain't Hollywood.
Well, it is Black Hollywood, number one. I'm going to just tell you right now.
Watch your mouth. But the governor would disagree about this ain't Hollywood when we
and
look
so
what the
Will Packer
and the movie-making industry here
exactly.
in the state of Georgia Absolutely. Is now only second to L.A., so he needs to look at his facts.
Well, this is a big deal, of course, especially about those people who are movie-makers, showrunners who have threatened to pull out of Georgia if Kemp were to win. I'm not going to go down that road, but I want to ask you a little bit more about this kind of
Wait a
idea.
Virginia.
Okay,
Virginia,
all right.
Let me just say this real quick. Because the cost of labor here is so much cheaper, we are not a unionized state.
Right.
Hollywood is not going to pick up and go if Brian Kemp is elected. They are making too much money in this state to pick up and leave.
It's all about the green.
It's all about the green.
So, is that all just a threat? Are those empty threats?
No, I don't think they're empty threats. But how many people said that if Donald Trump was elected, they were going to move to Canada?
Right,
they're still
right.
here.
Here we are. Right. But it's an important point that we should not overlook the economic benefit that the movie industry has brought to this state and the opportunities. I mean, the issue really in Georgia is an economic issue. And wherever we can find ways to employ people, where they can work hard, where they can make a living wage, we should be looking for those opportunities. So I say, Will Ferrell, come on back, okay?
Mm-hmm. And he will. He will. Right. And you will. And that gets back to your comment, Deneen, mm-hmm. about people needing to be trained. That's one thing the movie industry has done. They have opened schools or made connections
Absolutely.
With schools to train people in Georgia to be able to work in the movie industry.
Right.
So I don't see them picking up and going away.
Right.
As I said, we don't talk about candidates, but believe me, I don't think if Brian Kemp wins that they're going to pack up and leave.
Right. That's Monica Pearson. Deneen Milner and Christine White are also here. We're talking about the book For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Politics, among other things that we're talking about in our sort of free-ranging conversation today. We're on Facebook Live at A Seat at the Table's Facebook page. So I also want to pick up on the other point that Oprah made, that, you know, my grandmother couldn't vote, and so I am voting for this reason. And I wonder if for you, you know, you're all of different ages. Mm-hmm. You know, some were alive during the Civil Rights Movement, during the Voting
I'm
Rights
71.
Act.
I'm 71.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, I'm letting you say it there, Monica. But did you grow up in that shadow? Did you, were you told you have a responsibility to vote?
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely.
My parents took me to vote with them. Every time they voted, I was standing right next to them. And you know what I do? Every time I vote, my children are with me. And my older daughter is up at Yale in Connecticut. She just sent in her absentee ballot because she understands the importance of her right to vote.
Okay, I got to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Is she sure her absentee ballot?
Yes.
Well, that's the right. Is she
frightening. Boy,
this is so scary. I
mean, she did what she was supposed to do, but it's frightening. Yes. The idea that she could have the right to vote, be registered to vote, because we made sure that she was, and she can take her little stamp and lick it and put it on the ballot and send it, and it may not be counted. That is frightening.
Well, and that's why we have to organize.
And, right, and undermining the confidence of the vote. And we can check here in Georgia, just for the record, you can go to the Secretary of State website and check if your vote was counted.
But if you're out of town, and let's say, like me, luckily that, and this is the reason I didn't do absentee. I stood in line, but it was only 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Because this year, for some odd reason, I changed the signature on my name on the P.
Right.
I made it a bigger P than a smaller P. Well, that could, if I had done an absentee ballot, that would have been enough to pull it out because the signatures were not the same.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when would I get that notification?
Right.
So I am really more concerned about Georgia's the only state that is using all five things to keep you from voting.
Yeah.
Voting suppression in Georgia is real.
It is real.
Absolutely.
And it's sad. And I mean, I have to say that there are people who are working around the clock on phones, knocking on doors, trying to get out the people whose absentee ballots have been rejected. And we find that these are people who are in wheelchairs. These are people who are bound to their bed, who are taking care of elderly and disabled people, who are blind, who can't just go and fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a reason for absentee ballots. We have to protect that right.
Absolutely.
And it's really important. And to the point of our kids, I can't be more proud of my daughter who's been knocking on doors for the past 2 weeks with a nonprofit, making sure that people are educated about their civic rights. So, it's important from cradle to grave, we have got to make sure that we are protecting each other.
Would you ever find people that you speak to socially who say they don't vote?
Well, let me tell you what I saw when I went to the poll.
Yeah,
they do.
So are you the lady who wets your finger?
But when I was at the poll the other day voting, a man came in and he couldn't vote because he had been removed from the rolls and he didn't know he had been removed because he had not voted in a while. That's an issue.
Purged. Yeah.
Yeah, he had been purged.
Right.
So a lot of people have this interest in this year's election, but because they're just finding out now,
right,
just find that they've been purged, it's like their rights have been taken away from them.
Well, this is the thing. This idea that voter fraud is an issue is false.
Right.
There is misinformation all throughout Facebook, all over the media, that there is some issue with voter fraud. And every single study has said that voter fraud you're more likely to get hit by lightning than to have voter fraud in your jurisdiction. So, I mean, this is really propaganda to make it seem like there are people who aren't supposed to be voting, and to pull up the defenses and defend these draconian error voter suppression laws. And we have to just push against that with our own common sense.
I've got a note here from another Facebook watcher. Monica is on point. It's critically important to consider candidates' positions, voting records, intellect, and empathy, regardless of how they look, marital status. Keep the main thing the main thing. Stay on the issues.
And you haven't seen that in the commercials. I am so sick of seeing the big word radical conservative whatever it is. It's a shame that in today's media, people don't go to other sources of information.
Mm. Right.
You know, I take the time to go from the most liberal to the most conservative to just the wackos to find out how people are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm finding, everybody sticks in their lane and their silo, so they don't really know what's being said about the other person. Look at more than one website.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be talking about the echo chamber and the danger of that in the next segment. But while I still have you women on here, this is supposed to be the year of the woman. 92 was supposed to be the year of the woman. So many women came out and, you know, ran for office after motivated by the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas after being accused of a sexual harassment. This is supposed to be also the year of the woman. The Me Too movements happened, the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, a lot of people motivated. What? Is it going to stick this time?
I hope so. I hope so.
I have to tell you about this conversation I had during the last presidential election. I was a soccer mom on the field, And there was another woman who was born and raised in the South in Virginia, and now she lives out in Gwinnett County. And she said that a woman doesn't deserve to be president because she can't handle the job.
Oh, my God.
And
no.
I really wanted to, you know, I wanted to wring her neck. I'm like, you can meet this ground real fast and quick.
She can't be president because she can. You, baby, you can't be president because you can't handle the job.
What are you doing?
But how are you speaking for women all across the world?
Exactly. It was frightening. But there are people out there who are like that. And it's scary. It's a scary concept to know that women think that way. But what I'm heartened by is that there are so many more women who don't think that way and who are not only, you know, making the commitment to support women who are running for office, but also who are actually running for office. It's like, yo, if I can, you know, handle a PTA at, you know,
right,
my school, which is like some of the most political, you know, like, you know, foolishness that you could deal with, you can handle, you know, city, state, or federal government.
All right. I do not want to stop this conversation, but we have to do it. Mm. But we are going to continue the book club of the book at the table, and we want to hear your suggestions for our next book. We're going to try and do this monthly. This is a little bit of an experiment at this point. See how it goes. But please go to the A Seat at the Table or the On Second Thought Facebook page, hashtag ABATT, A Book at the Table. Thank you so much to Monica Pearson, Deneen Milner, and Christine White. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Stay with us for more On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Next week, rely on GPB. We're going to be bringing you up-to-the-date election coverage and coverage from the polls. Monday on the show, we're going to be walking through some ballot initiatives, those things that many people leave blank because they're so confusing to read, never mind understand, and follow the jagged lines of Georgia's voting districts. So you can join us for that on Monday at 9. But for now, the campaign to take a breather from campaign politics wins out. Time to kick back and relax with some new October releases from artists like Cat Power. She's got a new record out here with the singing with Lana Del Rey on the song Woman. Here to tell us what to add to our weekend playlist is Josh Jackson, editor-in-chief of Pace Magazine. Josh, thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Really glad you're here. So Chan Marshall, or Cat Power, new album Wanderer, her first in 6 years and first since the birth of her son. What, do we hear the life change in her record?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot has changed in her life. She actually said that she was very tempted to give up on music, move to Australia, change her name to Beth. But thankfully for us, she gave us her 10th album. And for those who don't know, here in Georgia, she was born in Atlanta, all kinds of Georgia connections, worked at Fellini's for a while. So she may have moved to New York, but we still claim her as our own.
Well, she has been, you know, she's always got a little bit of a reputation about being a little erratic. And she's been really forthcoming about her struggles with substance abuse and nerves and mental health. I've actually heard and seen her perform with her back to the audience.
Yeah, and particularly in the early 2000s, you didn't know what to expect when you went to a Cat Power show. You know, I think she's put a lot of that behind her. She still doesn't love the spotlight, it doesn't seem, but she's one of my favorites. Just that sort of languid, bluesy, soulful music, and I love the song that we just heard. That, you know, this is the year of the woman. Mm-hmm. We've got, you know, what better anthem than her song with Lana Del Rey there.
And a great, great cover of Rihanna's Stay. Just beautiful. Any other standout tracks for you?
You know, I am an album guy and to try to pull out songs out of the top of my head. So you can hear throughout the album just a little more raw emotion than I think we've gotten from her before, and that to me is a gift from someone like like Jan Marshall.
Another great Georgia band, R.E.M., announced the release of R.E.M. at the BBC. Now, this is a box set highlighting the band's career since their start in Athens in the 80s, including songs like many, many songs. But let's hear a little bit of World Leader Pretend.
Reach out for me.
So let's say, Josh, you're just discovering R.E.M. or want to discover more about them. Would this box set help you get a feel for them as a band?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, this is probably designed more for the R.E.M. completist, the person, you know, the person who can't get enough of what this band has done. But yeah, it really is an overview of their career, starting with a 1984 live broadcast from the town of Nottingham, which you got the early hits like Radio Free Europe, Don't Go Back to Rockville, Guarding at Night. And then it goes all the way through the band's 1998 John Peel session and even a couple songs from Radio 1 Live Lounge in 2008, near to the band's end.
So BBC, these were all recorded on the BBC?
All recorded on the BBC. You have in the UK a great tradition of bands coming in playing live songs. We do a little bit of that at Pace. We have, you know, a few bands come in each day and play for us. But you know, John Peel is the king of that, and that's a wonderful session that they've got there.
And discovered a lot of people in the
meantime, right? Yes, he did. That they introduced the first England and then the world to a lot of great new artists.
Okay, so back to Georgia. Musician Matthew Houck, he performs as Phosphorescent. What's his Georgia connection?
So he was born in Huntsville, Alabama, but he actually launched his music career in Athens, Georgia, like many, like R.E.M.
This seems to be a theme.
Yeah, he's since moved on, first to New York City and now back to Nashville. And again, like Cat Power, he became a parent since his last album. He's also he nearly died with a bout of meningitis a couple years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of life packed into this album. He's one of my favorite musicians that I just think not enough people know about. Plays under the name Phosphorescent, and his new album is called C'est la Vie.
Let's listen to a cut from that. It's called New Birth in New England.
She said, don't I know ya? Honey, don't I know ya? Honey, don't I know ya?
Ooh, it's got such a great little poppy, you know, reminiscent of another era sound.
Yeah, and on that track, you can actually hear his wife, Joe Shornikow. There's a lot about fatherhood on this album. There's that song. There's also another sweet song called My Beautiful Boy. You've got that pedal steel, you've got that hand percussion on that track we just heard. I mean, that jangly polyrhythmic sound. It's a beautiful record.
So that's Mike Houck. He performs his Phosphorescent new record called C'est la Vie. Celebration of la vie, it sounds like. How about, Josh, artists to see around Georgia? Willie Nelson's coming to Macon on November 10th. I mean, would you go see Willie Nelson because he's a legend, or is he still evolving, doing anything surprising at a Willie Nelson show?
Well, I mean, I think yes, you go see him because he's a legend. He's 85 years old now. And I don't know what to expect from my life at 85, but this is a man who's put out 13 solo studio albums since 2008. He has not stopped. He has not slowed down. You know, a lot of those are collaborations and special projects and covers albums, but there's even a few albums of original material there. He's still writing. Has been writing since 1962 when he wrote that Patsy Cline hit Crazy and launched his career, and 68 studio albums so far.
Wow, that is just astounding. What can we expect at a Willie Nelson show besides probably a lot of smoke?
You probably expect a lot of smoke. You can expect a lot of the hits. You can expect some of the new songs. You know, his one of his most recent high profile things was a song that he recorded for Beto O'Rourke. you know, he's still causing controversy.
Yeah, he lost a few fans for that one, I'm guessing.
I can't imagine which of his fans was not aware of his politics before now. He's never been shy about speaking out.
Anybody else you're looking forward to for coming up for live bands in the area?
Yeah, so if you're in Athens tonight, you've got Joy Williams from the band The Civil Wars, one half of The Civil Wars. She's playing at the Foundry tonight. Beautiful songs from a singer-songwriter who has had a ton of success with Civil Wars and now a ton of success on her own. In the Atlanta area, on the 5th, I would recommend Pale Waves and Mia Follick. Pale Waves is a band from Manchester, UK, and I know Liverpool gets all the ink, but I think Manchester has actually got more acclaim to musicians of note. The Smiths, Stone Roses, Oasis, New Order, more recently the 1975, and Pale Waves is another great one. And the opening act, Mia Follick, had one of our best albums of October that just came out.
So that's from Paste Magazine's picks for bands to see. We'll put a full list up at gpbnews.org. But finally, before we let you go, Tony Joe White, famed musician, songwriter, swamp rocker, died suddenly last week at 75. Here's the song that made him, his 1969 hit, Polk Salad Annie.
Every day for supper time, go down the truck patch, dig her miserable salad.
That song was redone by so many people. How would you define that swamp rock sound?
Oh, so swamp rock. So he's from northeast corner of Louisiana, right in that floodplain of the Mississippi River. And it's this languid groove, southern storytelling. You've got that. You can almost feel the Gulf Coast humidity in these songs. And it's just swampy.
Now, he was one of those guys that made the big hit, did not ever hit it real big after that, but was kind of that insider, you know, the musician's musician kind
of
thing.
Yeah, and actually wrote a lot of hits for others. He wrote Rainy Night in Georgia.
Heard of that one.
He wrote Willie and Laura Mae Jones for Dusty Springfield, Steamy Windows for Tina Turner, and, has just continued right up to the end. He was writing new music, touring. We actually had him in the Pace studio 3 weeks right before he died.
Whoa.
And he played 3 songs off his brand new album. So you can check out his brand new record, and go back and listen to those wonderful hits.
So where do we find these live performances?
So you can find them at pastemagazine.com. You just click on videos, and there's tons and tons and tons of stuff there.
Well, Josh Jackson, thank you so much for filling us in.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Jackson, he's editor-in-chief of Pace Magazine.
When you finally see the light, it's hard to know which one of us is caveman.
Okay, so from Cat Power's cover of Stay and Swamp Rockers to influences of another kind of quagmire, the role of mainstream and fringe social media sites in extremism and violence. Emory Marketing Professor David Schweidel studies the problems with social media echo chambers. And David's on the line with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
So, David, the links between social media and extremism, especially acute this week after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooter, a frequent user of Gab. How would you describe Gab?
Gab's been described as a platform where you're going to be allowed to have free speech with much less monitoring, much less censoring than you might have on Facebook or Twitter.
So what kind of stuff would you find on it?
Because of that, you're going to kind of get those extreme opinions. So you're going to see more racist activity, white nationalist activity happening on the platform.
So Did anyone, I know people have tracked his posts. I'm wondering if you have noticed any kind of patterns in the kind of thing, and we're talking specifically about the accused shooter, Robert Bowers, using gab.
Yeah, what we tend to see is that people are going to be drawn to other people who have the same opinions as them. And so once that opinion gets a foothold on a particular platform, it's going to start to attract others that are like-minded.
So they're not being challenged. And any evidence that these online echo chambers amplify? I mean, these are on a lot of other sites. There are little sort of clever memes that are dog whistles. This is full-on barking that we're talking about. Any evidence that brings extremist views more to the forefront inside of a person?
Well, I think the dog whistles that you mentioned that we see kind of on the more popular platforms, that's increasingly happening. So it's coming from what we might consider the fringes, the more extreme social media platforms, and it's starting to permeate the mainstream platforms.
Well, in response to criticism lobbed at their platform after information on the Pittsburgh shooter struck, Gab wrote on Twitter, "Words are not bullets and Gab isn't going anywhere." Should any responsibility be assigned to platforms like Gab or Reddit or Twitter or Facebook in violent acts?
This is the ongoing question of, yes, they're only words, but words are indicative of what's in the minds of the people who are saying them.
Well, there is an argument of who polices them. I mean, do you think that Twitter, Facebook, obviously they've hired a lot of people to try and regulate and to look out for violations of their terms of service. But should it be the social media platform? Should it be the FBI?
This is a tough question because the social media platforms, take Facebook and a Twitter, they're beholden to their shareholders. Ultimately, that's who they're going to be responsible to. And so, do we trust the social media platform to do the monitoring and to protect our right to free speech, but to protect the users of the platform? Or is that the role that government has to play? And so that's an ongoing discussion that's happening.
Well, could the argument be made that it is better to know what these people are saying than to have them, in some sort of deep, dark corner of the web having these conversations?
Absolutely. The idea of monitoring social media, there's a lot of information there about what people think and potentially about the actions that they're going to take. Now, there's the safety component that would come with monitoring, but then we've also got to weigh that against the potential downside of the false positives that it might trigger.
Do you think, David, it's not obviously the first time racist or anti-Semitic views have erupted into violence in U.S. history? How have social media platforms, however, do you think promoted these views in our time?
I wouldn't say that they've necessarily promoted, that the platforms have been the ones promoting them, but the platforms have certainly enabled it. And again, it goes back to what the platforms are trying to accomplish. As consumers, we see it as a means of connecting with other people. But if we look at Facebook, Twitter, any of our social media platforms today, they're advertising platforms. So their goal is going to be to get you to spend as much time on the platform as possible and engage with the platform. And the way I'm going to do it is to show you content that I think is going to interest you. And that's where we get the development and probably the acceleration of these echo chambers forming.
Well, given that there are so many of these kind of internet trolls exercising their right to speech on platforms, do people still take these threats seriously?
Yeah, I think we've got to distinguish between what is someone just saying something online that there's no credible reason to believe is going to be acted out, and that's going to be different from a person who's saying something online, and that might be consistent with other behavior that they've demonstrated that does signal a credible threat.
Well, David Schweidel, thank you for speaking with us. David Schweidel is a marketing professor from Emory University. Have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot. You too.
And that's it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor. Alex Word is our engineer. And Amy Kiley, our senior producer. You can join the conversation. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. And don't forget, we want your book suggestions for A Book at the Table. That's the hashtag ABATT. I'm Virginia Prescott. Have a great weekend. This is On Second Thought.